I'd like to inform parties today's conference is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If anyone needs any further assistance, press star zero. You may begin.
Okay, thank you. So this is our second installment of the Cassini Charm 7th Anniversary Telecon. Last month we had all the other disciplines, Saturn, Titan, Icy Satellite, and Magnetospheres, all crammed into one telecon. And because of speaker availability, this is how we've had to do it. And Jeff, I believe, was at the Rings workshop in Cornell, and so I think at the same time. And so he's going to be fully apprised of all the latest science results on ring science. So Dr. Jeff Cuzzi is our Cassini Rings interdisciplinary scientist, and he's at NASA Ames Research Center. And he's going to tell us about rings and dust science today. So take it away, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, Marcia. Mm-hmm. And welcome, everybody. Nice to be here. I'm going to try to speak into the handset because the sound quality is a little bit better, and see if I can do whatever I need to do with my hands. So here we are 7 years in to this great mission, and this startup slide is just a very pretty slide, primarily the rings with the planet in the background. It's a little confusing, and that's the whole point, just to throw you all off a little bit. But basically, we're looking at the unlit side of the ring, the side opposite to the side that the sun is shining on, and the sun is off to the left, and the shadow of Saturn is falling on across the top of the slide across the ring. So there's rings looking at the opposite side from the sun, but part of the rings is not illuminated at all. That's what that is. So there are regions that are seen to obscure the planet because of the material that's in them, and there are regions that are brighter, and there are regions that are darker. And you can do this on your own, but make it a little bit more obvious. Let's just go to the next slide, which makes a little bit more obvious what we're looking at here. I like these unlit faced. Somebody's making noise on their phone there. I don't think it's me. Okay, so I like this unlit face slide because it really shows you where all the material is. And here again, the sun is shining on the other side of the ring, so it shows the D ring close to the planet, which you really can't see in this picture, the C ring, the B ring, the A ring, the Cassini division, which is between the B ring and the A ring, and the little stranded F ring that I will have actually quite a lot to say about later in the talk, and the very diffuse G&E rings off the slide there. So what you see is that we're actually looking at particles that are lit from the other side. So rings where there are not too many particles, that light is getting through, and they're quite nice and bright, like the C ring and the Cassini division and the A ring to some degree. And the B ring, where there really are quite a lot of particles, that's really where all the mass is in the rings, that is looking much darker here. And there you can see in the very central, say, 20 or 30% of the B ring, very little light is getting through at all, except for these very intriguing channels that you can see in the center that I won't talk about today. But that's where all the treasure is buried there in the B ring. The next slide shows a more familiar view where the B ring is very bright, and that sort of central third or so is very bright here, but not so much brighter because basically the whole B ring is just reflecting pretty much all the light that hits it, and none's getting through. And you can see the Cassini division, the A ring, the Yankee gap in the outer part of the A ring, the little teeny Keeler gap at the very edge of the A ring. It's a beautiful color mosaic here, and the C ring, where you see these very interesting bands toward the outer part of the C ring that we really don't understand at all. They sort of straddle this gap called the Maxwell gap. So there's lots of stuff we don't understand. Almost all the irregular structure in the B ring we don't understand. So that is our quick review of the overall ring structure, just to kind of show you where it is. And the next slide tells you what I'm going to emphasize today. As Marcia said, we just had this wonderful workshop up at Cornell, and lots of terrific stuff got presented, which I won't have time to really discuss all of it, but so I'm going to focus on just a couple of different pieces that I think tell a kind of a cool story. And it emphasizes also that I think for the first time now, 7 years into the mission, we're really starting to see important contributions coming from outside of the Cassini project itself, because a lot of this data is in the public domain now, and non-Cassini people have free access to it. And of course, it's also takes a while to analyze all this complicated stuff. So we're starting to see this bow wave of exciting results. Just the fact that Cassini's been there for 7 years certainly does not mean all the science is out. So I'm going to talk about a few things here. I'm going to talk about the temperature of the rings and around equinox, which is the northern spring equinox for Saturn in 2009, where the sun went through the equator plane of Saturn. And I'll show a diagram that emphasizes that. And you can imagine at that time the rings will be very cold and lots of other interesting effects we saw at that time. I talked about that last year, including the second bullet at that time during equinox when the sun is coming, hitting the rings at a very grazing angle. We see vertical relief accentuated, just like when you want to take a beautiful picture of dunes on a beach. You don't go out there at noon. You usually go at sunrise or sunset, and that's when you see the vertical contrast. So I'm going to talk about that and some of the really interesting conclusions people are now starting to derive from some of the things we're seeing about objects hitting the rings over periods of hundreds or maybe hundreds of years, several hundreds of years. I'll talk about these propellers that you've heard about, which are big objects in the rings, that we can actually track their orbits, and how those orbits change. And then I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about several different aspects of the F-ring as revealed in a couple of different research projects, some relating to the cameras and some relating to the radio science team, where we have occultations of the ring, of the spacecraft by the ring. So I'll talk about that. And then finally, I'm going to talk about something that's not really conclusive but kind of interesting to me, about what the rings are made of and how we are making a little progress along those lines to understand their color. Okay, so that's the scope of the talk. Here's the promised geometry slide about equinox. So what this plot shows is a function of time is the opening angle of the ring as seen from the sun and the Earth. The red line shows the opening angle as seen from the sun when basically the it's a smooth decrease that goes to zero in sort of August of 2010. Here, let me try. I'm going to escape out of this for just 1 second. Okay. And the blue line shows the opening angle as seen from the Earth, so it wiggles up and down because the Earth's orbit is not entirely in the ecliptic plane. But basically, as we approach 2009, this angle tilted as the rings appeared edge-on to both the Earth and the Sun, although not exactly at the same time. And that was equinox. So at that time, we got all kinds of cool observations that I really talked about last year. Shortly after that, I'd say in late 2010, sort of July to September of 2010, which is nominally part of the year that I'm reporting on here, we had a couple more observations when the rings opened up. They weren't opened up very much, and that made it, as you can see from this plot, maybe only a few degrees. But that made it very interesting because that's the kind of opening angle that Voyager observed the rings at. So it was important to observe the rings at the same kinds of angles that Voyager did over 30 years ago. Okay, and then right around the end or fall of 2010, we went into a orbit phase which we call EQ1, which is where the spacecraft is just in the equator plane, which people like to observe the planet because the rings aren't in the way, but you know, that's when we go off to Hawaii and all this kind of thing. So we are now, since that time and for the rest of this year, in these equatorial orbits, and we will remain in these equatorial orbits until July of 2012, when you can see from this plot, the once we get back up out of the ring, you know, the opening angle will be much larger. They'll be very well illuminated, and so on. So we have this long hiatus, and during this hiatus, we have been analyzing a lot of data. So that is primarily what I'm going to talk about today. Even though there are really not an awful lot of new observations, there are quite a number of new and interesting results. Okay, so the next slide shows one of these. This is from the SEERS instrument, the thermal infrared radiometer. And it's kind of a, I guess you'd have to say, it's a mock-up or a computer simulation of what they would see if they could really look at all the rings at one time, which they can't, the lit side and the unlit side, because they do have observations of both the lit side and the unlit side around this equinox time frame, and the color indicates the temperature. So you can see from these blues and lavender colors and the scale there that the ring temperature was in the, say, 40 degrees to maybe 70 degree range, both on the lit side and on the unlit side. So the same temperature on the lit side and the unlit side. Okay, so these were the lowest temperatures ever observed, and it's not surprising because the sun is kind of edge on. The fact that they're the same temperature on both sides deserves a little bit of explanation. And that's shown on the next slide, where there's a schematic that illustrates the rings being illuminated three different ways, one directly by the sun, one by sunlight reflecting off of Saturn. Those would be the two yellow arrows pointing at that red box there. And the third thing is by heat from Saturn itself. And as you might imagine, when the dominant component is the sun hitting the rings directly, and as the sun goes into the ring plane, that basically goes away. So all we have is the thermal bath, the thermal infrared from Saturn heating the rings, and that is more or less symmetric all the way around the planet. Saturn's temperature is about the same on the lit face as on the unlit face, so it's just all glowing warm. And what we saw at that time was that the C ring and the Cassini division, which are optically thin, are actually warmer than the B ring and the A ring, which are optically thicker. And of course, the north and south side are essentially identical because there's really no difference between the sunlit side and the not sunlit side. Even the reflected light from Saturn is symmetrical on both sides. Okay, so the next slide kind of shows a plot of some of these SEERS temperatures as a function of distance from Saturn compared with some model calculations by the team. And what you can first see is that the temperature basically just goes up as you get closer to the planet. So it's kind of like cozying up to a little campfire on a cold night. That is, the closer you get, the warmer you are, because Saturn is really the primary heat source. So even though the Cassini division out at 120,000 kilometers is very similar in a lot of ways from the standpoint of its optical depth and the ring particle albedo and everything else to the C-ring, it's noticeably colder because the C-ring is just closer and Saturn's bigger. Okay, so you see that, and you see the B ring, which extends from around 91 or 92,000 to 115 or 120,000 kilometers, where the temperature dips noticeably down. And actually, you can actually see that it's in pretty good agreement with the models that are these colored lines, where you expect the optically thicker rings, this tau of 2.0, you expect the optically thicker rings to be colder because, you know, when you're looking on basically each face of these optically thick rings is really only seeing sort of heat from one side of Saturn, not both hemispheres of Saturn, whereas the optically thinner rings, these dashed lines up here, are seeing heat coming from both hemispheres of Saturn. So that's why they're warmer. There is an albedo effect as well, that the C-ring and Cassini division particles are darker, but you can see that's a smaller effect than just the optical depth. So to first order, that's what basically explains this. You see the B-ring is a little bit warmer than the models, and this could be due to a couple things. One is there could be some transport of heat around from both sides, but mostly it's probably that there are some small fraction of the B-ring area we know are actually holes or regions of very low optical depth in the ring where some of that lit phase heat is shining through. So that's probably what that is. Okay, so that's the Sears temperature results. Now I want to get to a whole different kind of a thing. This is corrugated rings here in the next slide. I guess it's slide 10. A lot of words on here, but let me just talk to the pictures. The panels at the bottom left show, the single panel basically shows the whole C-ring from the inner part of the C-ring at the right all the way out to the outer part of the C-ring where it meets the B-ring at the left. And then the bottom three are sort of close-ups of pieces of that. So they're enlarged up so you can actually see these little ripples that we could see only in the only at equinox. Did never see these any other time because they are these vertical warps. And you can actually see that the wavelength of these ripples is the smallest all the way over at the right at around 75,000 kilometers. And then as you go to 82 or 81,000 kilometers, the wavelength is a little bit longer, and all the way out at 88,000 kilometers, a little bit longer. But you know, there is the same kind of ripple pattern that mostly goes all the way through the C-ring. There had earlier been one of these same kind of patterns seen in the D-ring, which isn't really not shown here, and it turned out that this ripple has about the same wavelength as the one that was seen in the D-ring. So the explanation for this is, and I should say that right around the same time, a different group actually, or some of the same people, published a paper showing similar kinds of ripples in Jupiter's ring as well. Okay, those observations are really noisy and grainy, but it's pretty clear that the same effect is going on. In fact, both groups proposed the same explanation for both effects. And that explanation is kind of illustrated in the panel at the right. If you were to take a ring that was in the equator of Saturn and all of a sudden just tilt it by a little bit, you know, it's a flat ring and you tilt it and it's still flat, but now it's all orbiting in a slightly different plane than Saturn's equator plane, what will happen is that over time, these different orbits, which are actually, you can think of them as circular orbits at different distances from Saturn, all with the same inclination, each orbit at a different distance from Saturn precesses around the planet at a different rate. That is, it's still inclined, but the normal to the orbit describes a little cone around the planet's pole. Or another way to think about that is that the node of the orbit, the longitude where it crosses the ring plane, moves around, actually goes around in a backwards direction. So the rate at which this precession or regression of the nodes happens is faster close to the planet than far away from the planet. So this initially planar ring starts to wrap up, as you see in these two lower panels. So now actually the next slide actually shows this movie. Let's just look at that. And you can see as this wrapping up happens, the wavelength that you see of this warp gradually gets shorter. It starts out quite long, and then it gets shorter overall with time. And you can't really see in this picture, but it gets shorter faster in the inner parts of the ring because they are precessing or regressing the most rapidly. Okay, so you can imagine if by observing the wavelength of these ripples at even one particular time, you could make a pretty good guess as to when this initial tilting happened. And some of these observations actually have been seen at several different times, which has been actually done for the Jupiter ring. In the Jupiter ring case, The original impact has been traced very nicely to the Shoemaker-Levy 9 impact at Jupiter. Not that the comet itself hit the ring, that would just poke a hole and wouldn't do very much. But if the comet went by Jupiter and was disrupted and created a whole bunch of dust, as we know is exactly what happened the first time it went by when it got caught in orbit, this dust spreads out into a cloud, and when this cloud comes back and hits the ring right around the same time that the nuclei of Shoemaker-Levy 9 came back and hit Jupiter itself, this cloud basically sandblasts one whole side of the ring more than the other and produces this tilt. So that's basically the explanation. And just going back to the previous slide quickly, for the C ring itself, they can age date the event to 1983. Okay, so it's quite a formidable event, you know, maybe even a bigger one than Shoemaker-Levy 9. Comparable, you need about a cubic kilometer worth of small particles in this debris, spread out debris cloud to hit the ring in this sort of spread out way. And, you know, obviously you're not going to get the whole comet, so, you know, it's, and these estimates are rough, but it's a significant event. You might ask, well, why didn't we see anything? And a possible reason why we didn't see anything was that Saturn was in conjunction with the Sun at around this time in 1983, so it wasn't really being observed at all, or certainly not very well. So something very well could have happened that we just missed, and yet its fingerprints or its signature or its footprints are left in this very interesting evolving structure that we can observe for decades or even hundreds of years. Actually, in this case, only decades later. So that's pretty cool that you can actually see these signatures of things hitting the ring. Now, the next slide, skipping over the animation again, shows another related effect. This is now something that was observed by the Cassini radio science team very soon, just almost within this 1 year time period, but just before we kind of went into the equatorial plane. You can see that as seen from the Earth here, as all of our radio occultations are seen, because here the spacecraft is going by behind the planet, and so we observe the rings as they look from the Earth. So their tilt is getting very low, and these are very valuable radio occultations because they're really very, very sensitive to low optical depth material, because the fluctuations are now amplified by this very high tilt angle. We see almost nothing through the dense parts of the rings here, but we see them at other times. So this is a very important and very unique observation. We got a few more in this sort of July to October time frame that haven't been analyzed yet. But this one particular observation showed some very interesting things, which are shown in the next slide. This is the kind of thing that radio science observes. These are optical depths as a function of ring radius, and this is all in the C ring. And these are three different, there's two different wavelengths here. Ka band is about 1 or 2 centimeters, and X band is about 3.7 centimeters. And then we have two different stations, Goldstone and Canberra. So when you see all this good agreement like this, you know that this is not an artifact of the data analysis or something like that. It's a real signal. So all through the C ring here, over to the left, you see something called a Titan minus 1 to 0 bending wave, which we've known about since Voyager. And that's actually a vertical warp in the rings. These vertical warps are very strongly accentuated in these very low tilt angle observations. But we've known about that, but the new stuff is off to the right, which now is stuff we see going pretty much all the way through the C-ring, and that is absolutely new. So next slide shows a close-up of that. These are different pieces of the C-ring, and what you see are these wave packets, sort of things. The wave has a very distinct wavelength, but its amplitude kind of comes and goes. It's a classical interference pattern. If you have two different waves of slightly different frequency, they will constructively and destructively interfere with each other as they move at their different wavelengths, and that's pretty much exactly what we're seeing here. So the radio science team has now analyzed this. And, oh, I guess you should also notice that the top panel, which is closer to Saturn, has a smaller wavelength than the bottom panel, which is further from Saturn. And this is exactly the same kind of signature that we saw in those ripples in the C-ring, where the wavelength is shorter, closer to the planet. It's a signal of this wrapping up effect. So the radio science team has interpreted this this signal in very much the same way. Next slide shows they've taken a spectrum by Fourier analyzing those two beat patterns, and they see these nice peaks in the frequency spectrum right here. In the middle of the graph where the two dashed lines are, and indeed they are separated by a very small amount. Okay, so that's basically those two harmonics that they're picking up separately. So the next slide shows their conclusions. They have detected these two tones only about 1 kilometer wavelength. Now, this is a lot shorter than the imaging experiment could never detect anything this short. The imaging is looking at stuff at around 30 kilometers wavelength. So these are much shorter wavelength, and their separation is 110 meters, which is about 10%. Okay. So the fact that the wavelength increases slowly is in general agreement with this corrugation model. The amplitude of the corrugation is, they say down here, 4 to 10 meters. That's very similar to what the imaging sees in their corrugation, but the much shorter wavelength means this thing has been wrapping up for a much longer time. So instead of something, if you want to ascribe this to the same kind of event, instead of happening 20 or 30 years ago, it happened maybe 600 years ago in the 1300s, right? So this is amazing that we can actually see this signal of something happening in the 1300s still going on in the rings. That's pretty astonishing. And even happening 600 years ago, the fact that we have two of these things says that there was really two of them, probably associated with the same event in some way, right? Given the low probabilities of these events and the fact we haven't seen anything between the 1300s and 20, 30 years ago, probably says that these two events were associated with the same encounter. Something like, for instance, you have a comet coming by Saturn and maybe it gets broken up, and then it goes into an orbit that's maybe of a 50-year period. Okay, and then it comes back and blasts the rings once, and then whatever debris didn't hit it the first time came back 50 years later and blasted it again. Or maybe there was a binary comet that came by, and each one of them was responsible for one or something of that sort. So that is pretty cool that we imagine that we have from these two different experiments on these very different timescales, evidence of these collisions on the rings over this long amount of time. Now, you can sort of estimate the likelihood of this happening. All we have is statistics of very small numbers here. You know, the Shoemaker-Levy hit Jupiter. We knew that. Another comet hit Jupiter in the, I guess, just about 5 years ago or something like that. So we have very small numbers to estimate the rates, and Jupiter's capture rate is a little different than Saturn's, and so on and so forth. But when the imaging people estimated their probability of something big enough to cause that ripple hitting the rings in the last, say, 20, 30 years, they got a probability of between 1% and 0.1%. And now we have, three of these things, two or three of these things in 600 years. And I'm starting to think that, you know, that is telling us that maybe our statistics are a little bit off, because the imaging team value all by itself would have suggested that we only get those impacts every couple, you know, every 5 or 10,000 years. And here we've got a couple of them in less than 1,000 years. So, you know, this is maybe a good way to actually measure the rate at which things hit these giant planets, maybe the best way of all, in fact. Okay, let's move on to the next one. New topic, which would be these propellers that we see in the rings now. I've talked about these before. They are small objects that are too small to really open a full gap in the rings, but they disturb the nearby ring material, and that's what these two panels at the bottom left show, and the panel at the bottom right shows the disturbed orbits material going by this propeller, let's say, toward the planet, would be below, let's say, radius of zero in this right panel. So it's moving relative to the object from left to right. It goes by and it gets disturbed downstream. Material further away is moving slower than the object, so it moves from right to left. It encounters the object and it gets disturbed again, moving downstream but in the other direction. So these propellers have this asymmetrical appearance. So you don't really see these objects, but you do see these disturbances. And you can infer the size of the object from the disturbance, and they're thought to be about 100 meters in size, much larger than a typical ring particle, which is why they can disturb their surroundings. Next slide gives you an idea of this, what this kind of looks like. There really are flocks and flocks of these things, these little yellow dashes. Each one of them is one of these propellers. This is a one part of the A-ring. There are parts where you see them, and there are parts where you don't. They occur in three separate bands, and it seems like there's a spiral density wave here in the bottom of the frame, and it doesn't seem like the spiral density waves bother the propellers very much. They're just in that region. So we don't really understand why they're in these three radial bands, but there they are. So these are sort of typical propellers, of which there are probably tens of thousands of them. Next slide shows something a little bit different. Discovered by Matt Tiscarino, the imaging team. And these things are what they call giant propellers. They're actually big enough that you can detect them in low-resolution images far away from the planet, so you can actually find them in many images, and you can track their orbits. You can keep seeing them. And, you know, well, there's Blériot again, or there's Earhart again. And so the plot here actually shows what's called a longitude residual, which is the angular difference where this thing is seen from where you expect it to have been seen. So when it shows up at a smaller angle, that means it's moving a little slower than you thought. And when it shows up at a larger angle, it was moving a little faster than you thought. So what this oscillation about zero shows is that this object's orbit is sort of oscillating. Sometimes it's moving faster than average, and sometimes it's moving slower. So this was a bit of a puzzle, and there was a nice paper published this year, next slide, by Margaret Pan and Eugene Chang, where they explain this in a very natural way, that these propellers, because they clear out a little gap around themselves, the ends of that gap, if you like, act as little mass concentrations between which this object can oscillate slowly. And as it oscillates slowly, like a pendulum, it'll undergo what's called a libration here, and they worked out basically the likely period of these and the amplitude of these librations, and it agrees very well with what we see. So these propellers, and this is not the only one, are probably oscillating or librating back and forth in this mass hole that they create themselves. So, but then you can see from this plot that maybe it's a little bit more complicated than that. So, of course, there's probably other things going on. But this theory probably explains it pretty well. Okay, moving on to the F-ring. This is sort of an overview of the outer part of the A-ring, showing the Encke gap and its little ringlet, where the moonlit pan is in that gap. And then this much smaller Keeler gap at the outer edge of the A-ring, where moonlit Daphnis is in there. And then off to the right here, we have the multi-stranded F-ring. And you can sort of barely make out Prometheus here in this box, which is one of these so-called shepherding satellites, which we used to think was responsible for confining this ring, but now I don't think anybody believes that anymore. In fact, Prometheus is more of a disturbing object than a confining object. So let's go to the next slide. It shows a close-up of that little panel. There's Prometheus yanking out a little bit of material from the F ring and then sort of off up to the left from Prometheus, you can see a couple of dark channels. These are the remnants of previous encounters of Prometheus with the ring, because it is drifting slowly around because its mean motion is slightly faster than the F ring itself. Okay, so you a whole series of these perturbations trails behind Prometheus, and you can kind of see that in the bottom panel as well, only now these disturbances are quite a bit stronger, and that's explained by the fact that between 2004 and 2009, the orbits of Prometheus and the F-ring, as shown in blue and red, both precess around, just like I mentioned earlier with the nodes regressing, the longitude of the periaps precesses around as well, but at different rates. So in 2009, the apoapse of Prometheus, which is its furthest distance from the planet, was lined up with the periapse of the F-ring, which is its closest distance to the planet. So the perturbations of Prometheus were the strongest, and that's why we see this very strong perturbation, like in the bottom right panel. Okay, so we were expecting some kind of dramatic stuff. Well, we haven't quite seen it yet, but if you look at the bottom left panel, you can get an idea that sometimes this can take a little while to occur. Because the last time Prometheus and the F-ring had this alignment was in 1993 or 1994, I believe. And here we see, these are Hubble pictures taken when the last time the sun went through the ring plane, which is a great time to observe the rings because they're very, very dark. You can actually take a picture that shows the F-ring, let's label raw, let's say here, and subtract out the average, and then you see these very faint pictures called template subtracted raw, those two ones on the right. And if you go to the next slide, you can see these things called arc C and arc D. They're circled in yellow ovals now. And these things are real, and they can actually be tracked. So they're really huge things to be seen this way from Hubble, much bigger than anything we've seen with Cassini so far, and they move at a different rate than the typical F-ring does. So these are obviously the results of some kind of big collision that was probably caused last time Prometheus was close to the F-ring. But it takes a while because everything is, you know, collides, you know, the optical, the number density of big enough particles to make a clump this big is pretty low. So even though they may get excited by Prometheus, they don't necessarily collide right away. So here's at least some evidence that this kind of thing does happen. Okay, moving on to other results from the F-ring. This is some work done by Rob French and Mark Showalter at SETI Institute. And what this shows is these are basically the brightness of the F-ring as a function of phase angle. And what phase angle means is over here near zero, that's like backscatter, you know, the sun and to the ring and back to the observer. And over at the right, where the phase angle is high, that's what we call forward scatter. So the sun is kind of shining through the ring and on to you. So it's brighter because the dust, these small particles tend to diffract the light in your direction and focus it into a smaller range of angles, so the ring looks a lot brighter. So the fact that the ring has this phase curve at all indicates that many or most of the particles are small, and that's been known for a while, but what we see here is that the overall brightness of the ring is just going up by a factor of between 2 and 3, without any doubt at all, given the scatter in the points between Voyager and Cassini. So that's pretty cool. There's certainly something going on, and maybe it's related to these disturbances. The next slide looks at what happened just over the time period of Cassini on the left, and it shows that there wasn't much change in the brightness of the ring just over the time period 2004 to 2009. And if you remember the... Actually, the slide on the right kind of shows the, as a function of time, the distance between Prometheus and the ring. So the blue line shows that, and in 2004, sort of at the left side of that broad yellow band, Prometheus is moderately far away, And then in 2009, it's getting much closer. So over that period, if it was as simple as that, you would expect to see a lot going on, but obviously you, from the panel on the left, you really don't. Okay, so maybe the mere approach of Prometheus to the Efring over this five-year period hasn't created this, and maybe it's something that happened earlier. So the next slide says, well, okay, but there was this whole earlier encounter that nobody really saw. It was sort of between the Voyager time period and the Cassini time period. In fact, it's close to this this time period where the ring plane crossing happened that I showed you a couple slides ago, where McGee et al. Saw those giant clumps. So it's not out of the question that something really monstrous happened at that time. In fact, we know that something did. And maybe that's what contributed to the increased brightness of the F-ring as you measure it, say, between Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 and Cassini. So clearly, there's a lot of cool stuff going on in the F-ring, and a lot of it happens in this sort of a sporadic sort of fashion. Surely the mix of the stirring up by Prometheus has a lot to do with it, but there may be these kinds of delayed reaction things, and things may not happen right away. Okay. Okay, next slide. Now we're going to go back again to radio science and talk about the core of the F-ring. We have many occultations. These are stellar occultations when stars are seen to go behind the F-ring from Cassini, and we have both the VIMS and the UVIS instruments on Cassini can observe these at two very different wavelengths, the near infrared and the ultraviolet, but the structure that they see is kind of the same. It has a typical, you tend to see primarily a main core that tends to be sort of between, you know, 10 and 50 kilometers wide. That tends to be what they see, and that's also more or less what we see in the images. These bright strands that you see are sort of 10 to tens of kilometers wide. But the next slide actually shows some of these radio science occultations, and there's two things to realize on this slide. First, just look at the width of this radio science occultation here compared to 10 kilometers, so it's maybe only a kilometer or 2 kilometers wide. So it's much narrower than, going back on the previous slide, much narrower than what we see at shorter visible wavelengths. And probably why that is radio science is not sensitive to tiny little particles like the visible wavelengths are. They're only sensitive to centimeter and larger size, or let's say millimeter and larger size particles. And so there probably is this very central core of material that's large particles that radio science is seeing, and it's very, very narrow. The other thing that's interesting is radio science only sees this core in about one-third or so of the occultations that they get, 15 out of 49. So they don't always see it. There's a lot of time it's just not there at all. So this core of big particles is just not continuous. It's azimuthally discontinuous, and it has not been put together yet whether or not it is somehow broken up in longitude or occupies a fraction of longitudes, but more or less continuously. I think it's probably the latter. I haven't heard the radio science team say anything conclusive about that, but I'm sure they should be able to tell us that at some point. And we know this is not a clump because the nature of the radio science experiment, it has to be extended at least tens of kilometers or hundreds of kilometers along the orbit, otherwise they wouldn't see it. So it's not just a clump, it's a strand, and it's very, very narrow. So the F-ring looks a little bit different to different observers, like the elephant looks to the five blind men. Here's another, next slide, slide 29, shows another radio science occultation. Every now and then they'll see another strand off here where the red arrow shows. Notice that this lies outside of the nominal F-ring core. So this is something that not even the imaging has seen quite yet. So I'll show you something in imaging has seen that looks a little bit like this, but it's not because it occurs to the inside of the main efferent core. Okay, so let's go on to the imaging and a whole nother kind of structure. Now, so far we've just been talking about the efferent as if it were sort of a single strand or entity of material, and these images really make it very clear that it's a lot more complicated than that. The top left image shows sort of a whole 360-degree unwrapping of the F-ring, and the first thing you see is extremely jaggedy on a very short time scale. That is, these are probably just spikes that are caused by objects that are set in motion by Prometheus, and they have about the right, that's got about the right wavelength. So that's probably a result of Prometheus. And then you see these wispy-looking jets kind of crossing the F-ring at different tilt angles, and I'll have a lot more to say about that. But you see they occur at a variety of longitudes pretty much all through the F-ring, and there's this one giant one right through the middle that has sort of two parts, one that's more nearly perpendicular to the ring and one that's more nearly tilted. And if you sort of follow that tilt all the way to the right, where it goes off the graph to the right, you can see it kind of comes back in on the left, so that's the same strand. So these have been modeled. The model on the bottom left actually shows a model of what happens if you have some kind of object crossing through the F-ring and crashing into it and ejecting stuff out over a range of semi-major axes. So you're basically creating material that now has a range of different periods by, you know, you're crashing through and you're throwing stuff around, so it's no longer exactly in the F-ring orbit, which has a single period. It has a range of periods. So stuff that has a shorter period drifts ahead, and stuff that has a longer period drifts behind, and that's what creates now these slanted jets with different tilts. They're basically the results of something that crashed through pretty much at the same longitude, but at different times in the past, and the ones that are more slanted just happened a longer time ago. But you can also see that there are some of these events that happen at very different longitudes, and they had to be created by a different object. So these things can't all be created by the same object, but a lot of them are. And that object is shown in these right-hand panels here. It's called 2004 S6. It was discovered all the way back in 2004, almost invisible in the discovery picture. These are actually not the discovery picture. They were taken a lot later than that, and you can see the thing looks a little bit like a comet because it has like a burst of material kind of coming off it. These probably happened subsequent to a collision that this object had with the F-ring and actually knock material off itself, so that material is sort of more or less drifting along with this object and spreading out over time, and then after weeks or months, this jet of material actually vanishes. But you can also see directly on this pair of pictures that in the bottom one, for instance, that object is clearly outside of the F-ring, and on the top one, it's clearly inside of the F-ring. So it's got to cross through the F-ring, and indeed it does. And when its node on the orbit of the F-ring occurs at the same longitude where it physically goes through the F-ring, you get one of these collisions. So it doesn't always happen, but when it does, you get a burst event like this. Okay, next slide shows a bunch more of these. So these were actually taken in late 2006 and early 2007. And these jets are, again, you can see these jets. Here's a radial one, and then there's another radial one. And then by the time you get to time C, that radial one is sheared out into a tilted one. You get another radial one, and so on. So here's the time series. And the circle and the square actually show the predicted position of this 2004 S6 and another object that has never really been exactly tied to it, but was seen in 2007, probably is the same object. So it's probably the same object crashing through the F-ring over a period now, you know, of several years, and when it does, it creates all this havoc. Okay, so next slide kind of shows how this happens. The cartoon on the right shows a jet of material that's created, let's say, radially with a range of semi-major axes, that is, different orbital distances from Saturn. And then as time goes on, you get this red structure where it will start to slant or tilt because each one of these pieces of material at a different semi-major axis goes around a different rate. So it starts to tilt up, and that's what gives you this slanty structure. So that all works pretty well. You can date these things, and that all works great to explain things like the top panel. Now, in the next slide, slide 33, you see kind of what I've been showing you, but on the bottom panel, you see something very, very different. And this almost looks like another F-ring that was created here. But, in fact, it's probably just an unusually large and dense gout of material that was tossed out by a very vigorous collision. You notice it's very narrow. It's not spreading and getting all wispy like these other guys are. So there's probably a definite core of larger stuff in there that you can see those radial wiggles and spikes. Again, probably caused by lumps of big stuff perturbing the ring as they get excited by Prometheus. So this is a pretty unusual thing. It's certainly the first thing we've seen like this in the in the 4 years, three or 4 years up to this point that Cassini has been there. Next slide shows a little bit later now. This is even 2 years later, so this is pretty recent. This is 2009 or so. And now this is a negative view, but you see the F-ring core with its various jets, and then down at the bottom at about minus 150 kilometers, you can see this jet. It's now pretty much all wrapped up, doesn't look like a spiral hardly anymore, but it's got all these lumps and bumps of material, so these are probably pretty sizable clumps that are surviving. Maybe they're massive objects, maybe they're accreting material around them. And now these things are on very different orbits from the F-ring. Their semi-major axis, their period is just different. And they can get excited by Prometheus, and they can start acting like 2004 S6. And as their eccentricity gets excited over time, they can start crashing through the F-ring again, and the whole process can keep on unfolding like that. So this is a very interesting event. Okay, now we can kind of just get an idea how these things wrap up. Next slide is some more from French and Showalter, and this I'm just going to skip through a couple of these very quickly because it's sort of a sequence. If you just compare, here's the first observation, a very bright clump at a particular longitude in the ring. This is averaged over the whole ring, and this illustrates, again, as you just scroll through for the next couple of pictures, how this bright clump moves to larger longitudes, so basically it's moving faster than the rest of the nominal F ring, so it must have been ejected with a slightly shorter period or a smaller semi-major axis, and eventually as you go to the end of the sequence, it kind of spreads out and goes away, so it's getting just swept up by something else. So that's just another entirely different clump. Shows that it all this happens over a period of, about a year from January of 2007 all the way to July of 2008. So some of these things are pretty long-lived. Okay, so now the next slide here, slide 43, actually, this is one of the last things that we saw before we went into one of these, into this equatorial sequence. This was actually observed in October 2010, and it's a giant burst that happened in the core of the F-ring, and you can really see the whole central core of the F-ring there is just really, really messed up. So this is would have been really cool to follow this over a long period, but it will probably be gone by the time we get back. But for sure, it's just another example of how this stuff just keeps on going. And if you look closely at this picture, you can see sort of dark, angular, wedge-shaped pattern in this faint material above the clump and inside of it, and this is called a fan, and it's caused by the presence of a massive object embedded somewhere in that clump. So probably in this particular encounter, was with a pretty massive object, maybe 2004 S6 or something like it, hit something pretty big in the F-ring and caused all this havoc and maybe excited the eccentricity of what got left behind, so it's now causing this fan. So lots and lots of interesting stuff going on in the F-ring. Okay, so now I want to move sort of to the last section here, which is ring composition. And we know that the rings are reddish. And, I forgot to put in my standard ring color picture, but you've all seen it several times before. And if not, go back and look at last year's charm talk. But the rings are not quite white. They are definitely have a reddish color. And so it's a bit of a mystery as to why that is. So there have been two separate suggestions made over the last couple of years. One is that they could be reddish because of good old-fashioned rust, like on this tractor here and like on Mars, which is a mineral called hematite, or maybe just iron itself. Iron metal can do that. Or the reddish nature could be due to small organic molecules, these multi-ring structures called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. And these little test tubes show a couple of PAHs. Carrots are orange because of a PAH called carotene, which is about a five-ring PAH sort of up in the top row of these structures here. Tomatoes are red for sort of the same reason. So whether or not the colorant is organic or inorganic, obviously that's pretty interesting to know. It's got to tell us something about the origin of the ring, so we do definitely want to try to understand this. So next slide shows you the ring spectra as spectra. And yeah, they're red, and other outer solar system things are red, and for a while it was just assumed that, well, okay, they're red because maybe they came from some outer solar system thing. But the more we learn about the rings from Cassini and the more we learn about these outer solar system things, the red is not quite the same red. So the top two panels, basically, the top panel shows the A and B ring and the C and Cassini division. This is brightness as a function of wavelength. And what you see there, first of all, there's these water ice bands at 1.5, 2, and 3 microns. And we know the rings are almost all water ice. And then the spectrum is almost flat, shortwards of that, except for this very steep downturn at around half a micron or 500 nanometers down into the UV. So we now talk about the rings as having a UV absorber. It's a little bit more specific than just saying that they're red. So if you compare that spectrum with the spectra of the icy satellites, Mimas, Tethys, Dione, and Rhea, you can see they're kind of qualitatively like that, flat through most of the visible, a little bit of a downturn in the toward the ultraviolet, but it's definitely weaker in the satellites than it is in the ring case. Now, there are other satellites, like Iapetus and Hyperion in the third panel, where the spectrum looks rather different. It's actually red-sloped all the way out, all through the visible and out into the infrared. It's a totally different slope overall than in the rings and icy satellites. And the Iapetus Hyperion case is much more like most of these outer solar system TNOs like Sedna and UG5 that have this very similar kind of a just linear red spectrum all the way out into the near infrared. So there's a difference here, and that's kind of interesting. However, there is one exception. The next slide actually shows some up in the top panel. Again, I plotted two other TNOs, Triton in green, and I got the name wrong here. This is UB313. It's actually Eris, not Nibiru. All these Eskimo names get me a little confused, but you can see they have sort of a similar enough kind of a spectrum to the ring that is steeply absorbing in the UV and more or less flat across the visible wavelength. So there's some clues here as to what's going on. Obviously, Triton and Eris is the biggest outer solar system object. It's bigger than Pluto, and it's quite white. It's not reddish at all. It's got this high albedo, and Triton is kind of the same. It's also very, very big. So these are big, differentiated objects. So that's telling us something. Let's go on to the next slide, which is a slightly more complicated version of what I showed you, and that is we are plotting the the short wavelength slope on the horizontal axis. That's the 0.35 to 0.55 micron slope. And on the vertical axis, we're plotting the long wavelength slope where the rings are actually flat. They're right near zero. You can see the A ring and the B ring are way out here, very red, very strongly sloped in the 0.35 to 0.55 micron range, but almost flat in the rest of the spectrum. The A ring and the B ring. The C ring and the Cassini division are sort of buried in here with this other mass of points, which is all the various other Saturn satellites. Okay, so clearly the A ring and the B ring are somehow very different. And this little set of red diamonds is actually Prometheus, which is in some models actually created from the rings. So if that's true, it's not surprising that Prometheus has the same kind of color as the rings. But one thing we don't really understand yet is just why the rings are so much steeper and redder at these short UV wavelengths. Why is their UV absorber so much stronger? We don't understand that. But I do want to say just a few words in the next slide about this, about how this works. This is some kind of just recent work that ties the UV absorption in the rings to bigger parts of the universe. You might say, well, how is it that this carbon can actually cause this UV absorption? And it has to do with these rings of carbon. I won't get into this in a lot of detail, but some of you who have studied the galaxy and the wider universe beyond know that in the upper right panel here, we see this is the extinction of starlight in various parts of the galaxy. And the extinction of starlight as a function of wavelength with longer wavelength to the left. Okay, so the V and the B is the visual wavelengths, and this extinction just goes down and down as you get to longer wavelengths because these particles are so tiny they're just not blocking the starlight. It increases as you go to shorter wavelengths, and then there's this bump here at 217 nanometers. And this has been known for decades, and it's been long attributed to graphite or graphite-like rings, and it's because of the electron structure in these graphite rings, these orbitals that I probably won't go into much, but there are these electron orbitals associated with the graphite rings that tend to absorb light only at this 200 nanometer wavelength. So it could very much be that what's causing the UV absorption at around 200 nanometers in the rings might very well be the same kind of materials that are responsible for absorbing the light of the stars in the galaxy. So that would be a very natural connection, actually, of Saturn's rings with the primitive material that we're all made from. If it turns out to be rust, that's a little harder to figure out how that might have come about. Okay, so the next two slides just kind of shows you a couple of spectra from models that people have put together, me, actually, so I take all the responsibility for these. The black lines and squares are Cassini data, and they show the strong UV absorption, shortwards of about 5,000 or so angstroms. The upper black one is the A ring and the B ring, and the lower black one is the C ring, and it's a lot more subtle there. The top two curves are model curves, and the black and the cyan, that just shows what you'd get if you had pure water ice, or maybe pure water ice with ammonia. So it's absolutely white all through the visible wavelengths and has this knife edge at around 1,700 angstroms where water absorbs. But the red curves show what you might get if you had this tiny iron grain, so you can get sort of a reddish spectrum depending on the size of the iron particles or exactly how they scatter. It doesn't look like it's quite got the right shape to me, but these it's very hard to model iron particles in the very, very tiny size range. So we're working on that. The next slide shows what you do with some of these laboratory-based organic materials in the red curves. You can do a little bit better matching the steep slope at the red in the ultraviolet, and then you can bring the level down by adding a little bit of soot, just regular old carbon. Maybe that came in with the meteoroids that are bombarding the rings over the eons. So these are just models that people are doing right now. There's going to be some Hubble observations in the next year or two, Hubble can actually look in this very interesting spectral region between 1,500 angstroms and 3,000 or 4,000, where really nobody else can. There's this big gap there in the Cassini data, so we're excited to see how that's going to work out. Anyway, that's pretty much all I wanted to say. I'm happy to take any questions anybody might have, though.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. That was really interesting. So let's barrage Jeff with questions. Who wants to start?
Or not. I've driven everybody away.
It's hard to get questions out of the group.
This is Lynn again. I had a question on slide 8 all the way back. The rest was quite clear for me.
Okay. That's good.
And wait a minute. I have to get back there, too. It was a slide about temperature versus radius, and it seems there's a big scatter at low and high, and a sort of a consolidation in middle of the points. And I was wondering what causes that.
Oh, you're saying why are the points somewhat more condensed and collapsed in the dark part of the bearing? That's a good question. My guess is going to be that there's a lot of structure in those regions that we're actually seeing, that is in the C-ring. You know, it's got these plateaus, and it's got gaps, and it's got ringlets. Same thing in the Cassini division, same thing in the A-ring. Structure on sort of length scales that are sort of unresolved or poorly resolved by the Sears experiment, and it may just be that that's causing this scatter. That is, there may be real temperature structure in there that there's less of in the B-ring because it's a more homogeneous target.
Okay, thank you.
That's just a guess, though, because you think that if we're just pure noise, you'd expect the noise would be higher where the temperature is lower. Another possible explanation is that the beam is actually not entirely filled in the C-ring because it is optically thin after all. So what we're backing out here is temperature, and that has to be derived from a total intensity. So even though the temperature is higher in the C-ring, the intensity may very well be lower because the ring is optically thin. So if the intensity is lower, the errors will be higher. That's another possible explanation.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Another question out there?
Yeah, this is Don.
Go ahead.
Hey, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to help explain this to fifth graders a little bit. And I'm wondering, since the impact in the ring that causes the ripple, it seems to be at a high velocity.
Right.
Does that movement continue at a high velocity, or does it slow down considerably immediately?
Okay, well, what actually happens is it's actually not one impact. It's like more of a sandblasting. It's like being blown by a wind. That's another way to think about it. It's a wind of tiny dust particles.
Uh-huh.
And these particles are all much smaller than the ring particles. So they don't really... You know, they don't feel like they're getting knocked. It's just, you know, in these many, many little hits, their momentum, their angular momentum is changing. It's more like, I don't know, a door swinging in a breeze or something like that. That's kind of more what it's like. Or
curtain?
A curtain, yeah. The ripple is a different effect.
Right.
The ripple is this differential wrap-up because of precession, but this impact that actually changes the tilt of the ring as a whole is very, very spread out, very diffuse kind of an impact, more like just like a wind blowing on it and just steadily pushing one side of the ring down over, like a gust of wind. Maybe that would be the way to think about it. A gust of wind hits it at one point of time and then goes away. There's no more gust of wind. But the whole ring has got tilted as a result of that, and then it winds up over time.
Okay, that helps. Thanks.
Sure.
Another question for Jeff? I just had a couple technical things. On your last couple of slides, there's a character that I'm not recognizing. I should have checked this before the telecon. It says sub-dash And then I get this weird icon. What should that read?
Okay, now what slide is that?
Just the last two slides, 48 and 49.
Okay, let's see. That could be a PC Mac thing.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
There's a mu. That's a Greek mu.
Okay, so there's a mu. Submicron.
Submicron iron. So that is supposedly little iron particles that are, well, they have to be, for this theory to work, they have to be much smaller than the wavelength.
Uh-huh.
So you can basically model it in a particular way where the particle is much smaller than the wavelength, but you know the properties because it's iron. So that's submicron iron. Now, there's another regime, just to carry this just for your own information, if you make the particle really, 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 really small, then you get into these nano-sized particles that are only a few atoms or tens of atoms across, and then the material properties start to change. And if these particles are nanoparticles, as, for instance, these pods, these little organic molecules, they really kind of are nanoparticles. They're like a tenth of a nanometer or a nanometer in size. They're much smaller than the wavelength. Once you get to that regime, then you have to be a little bit more careful about how you model the behavior of these particles. So that's sort of the state of the art isn't quite there yet, but we're getting there.
Okay, that's a distinction. So I guess next year we're going to start heading back up in inclination. What are we going to start to look for in terms of rings, highlights, ring science observations in the early part of the incline phase?
Well, the early part, unfortunately, we'll get there around the time that I'm talking this year or next year, but there won't be any observations probably much to talk about by that time because we'll have just got the spacecraft out of the equator plane by, let's say, next July.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but as soon as we do, we've got all kinds of things pretty much more of the same. We're going to keep tracking these propellers, watch their orbits evolve. We're going to do a lot more ring color because there wasn't an awful lot of ring color done in the prime mission. So we're going to do a lot more of that. We're going to have, we're going to do more high-resolution radio profiles of the rings in the ultraviolet because now we realize that there's something pretty interesting going on in the ultraviolet. Even though the resolution of that instrument is pretty low, we're going to be looking for moonlets in the various gaps in the Cassini division. Something I didn't talk about today very much, but I did last time, was that there are these gaps in the Cassini division where it's been theorized they had to be caused by little embedded moonlets, but it's a puzzle that nobody's ever seen them. So we went on a much more dedicated search for these moonlets. But in the ensuing couple of years, there's a new theory that suggests that these gaps in the Cassini division might be due just to sort of ripples along the outer edge of the B ring that are causing these gaps. So we're also going to be tracking the outer edge of the B ring much more closely. So a number of things, following up on the F-ring and tracking for more glitches and clumps and stuff like that. So basically following up, we're looking for time variations, things that may happen, more clumps like that, and also looking a lot closer at things that didn't get studied as carefully as they should have during the main mission.
Great. So any final questions for Jeff before we let him go? Sounds like maybe not. So thank you very much, Jeff. That was really wonderful. Very nice talk and great graphics and very thorough. So we really appreciate it. To the CHARM participants out there, we're thinking about maybe reducing the frequency of the CHARM telecons. We do have one scheduled for next month. We're going to take a little bit of a digression, and I've got three of the Cassini operations people. They're going to this DragonCon convention, perhaps some of you have heard of it, and they're preparing talks, and they're going to give this talk, a talk based on their DragonCon talks, and it's going to be a year in the life of Cassini, so that'll be in September. And then, like I said, at that point we might think about reducing the frequency. It might be quarterly or it might be a little more sporadic, but we'll keep keep doing the charm telecons, but it might not be a monthly event. So any final remarks from people out there?
Yes, I have one. This is Rachel Zimmerman-Brockman. I do formal education for Cassini.
I know there are
a lot of solar system educators on the line. I wanted to make sure they were aware that we're holding a Cassini Scientist for a Day essay contest this fall. And the deadline is October 26th. The three targets are on our website, which is saturn.jpl.nasa.gov/scientist-for-a-day. And the essay topics this year are Hyperion, Rhea and Titan, and Saturn. And the contest is open for students in grades 5 and 6, 7 and 8, and 9 through 12. It's both national and international. We have 24 countries involved so far.
Oh, that's wonderful.
We're aiming to get essays from all 50 states this year. So I encourage all of the teachers out there to encourage their students to participate in the essay contest, which does meet both national standards for education in English and science.
Excellent. Are the essays are all in English, I presume, or how are you?
The U.S. essays are all in English, but other countries can set their own deadline, their own deadlines and essay topics. Well, the topics are fixed, but.
And they'll be evaluated by native speakers, I guess.
Yes, they'll be evaluated. Yeah, each country has their own judges.
Uh-huh.
So we have Cassini scientists and educators judging the U.S. entries, but other countries choose their own judges.
That's great. So this is the first to have it be international, right?
It's been international in the past for the International Year of Astronomy, and we've always had support from both the U.K. and India to have their own international contests. But they run in parallel, so they don't get any U.S. government funding to run the international contests. And the prizes for students are their essays go on our website. They get a certificate of participation or a certificate that says they're a winner if they win. And all of the classmates of the winner are invited to winners, plural, are invited to participate in either a teleconference, a video conference, or a Ustream web chat with Cassini scientists to have their Saturn questions answered by the experts.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, good for you. That's great.
Thanks.
Any other questions, remarks?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next month.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.